appreciate the young people participating and helping out today and the special music and all facets of this. So do this again next year. As we begin the sermon today, we're going to look at a couple of images, maybe. As you can see, you know, we as the church have always we've taken a great deal of interest in the young people of the church. And, you know, our goal is for them to develop a relationship with God, not a relationship with me or a relationship with other ministers or a relationship with the staff at a camp or something like that. What we want to point them to is to a relationship with God, because that's what really is going to last and what's going to matter. And people are important to that, but that's not the central focus. And so we're trying to take that approach, which I think is what God wants us to do long term. With that, we'll begin the sermon. So I would like you to look at, have a couple of images that I wanted to begin my sermon with today. And these images are from the Office Depot website. And what they're doing is they're promoting promoting something that they think, from their perspective, is quite important. And it's, so you have the Born This Way Foundation that is empowering youth, inspiring bravery, and they're combining with Office Depot, and they're supplying kindness. And they're trying to get the people that are aware of this to become involved, as it says down in the corner. And then they this is another part of what they have on display on their website, and that is part of this. Like it talks about being amazing yourself and accepting, kind, involved. And two of the things that they're talking about is to be brave and to be courageous. And that's very much a part of this particular promotion. And it's a back-to-school promotion. You notice the bright colors, you notice, and all of that is geared toward appealing to young people. And and as you think about this, you know, is there a problem? We don't want to look at that for the whole time. So anyway, you might move that over in front of that so they can't see it. But anyway, so what you have here is a promotion that is geared toward young people. It's got bright colors, they've got wristbands, they've got pens and pencils, and all of these back-to-school things that kids can purchase in order to support this particular promotion. And as you think about that, what could be wrong with courage and bravery and kindness and acceptance? Well, as you look at this and you really stop and contemplate what it's all about. Beyond the bright colors and the lofty words of the advertisement, it becomes clear that this is an effort to promote sin and acceptance of sin among school-age children. Now, today is Youth Day, and in light of the effort to influence our young people in this age, I thought it would be worthwhile to discuss the subjects of courage and bravery, and to ask the question, you know, can you be involved with sin and be brave and courageous? So we'll take a look at that, because we're going to look at it from a biblical point of view and analyze what's happening here. We value the young people of the church, and we do want them to be courageous and brave. And as young people, that's one of the things that we want them to do, is to be challenged, but to show bravery and courage as they face the challenges that come in their lives. But we want them to be courageous and brave while being in harmony with God's Word. And so what we're going to do is examine what the Bible tells us about courage and bravery. And so I've entitled my sermon, Young, Courageous, and Brave. Let's go back to Psalm 127. Psalm 127. You know, as you think about God and children, you know, if you went back to the Garden of Eden, went back to that Friday when the man and woman were created, that was the pinnacle of the creation, of the physical creation. God was thrilled to have this man and woman to be created as physical beings with the potential to be a part of his family forever. He was their creator and he is their father, and he wants them to be born into his family forever. And just like all of us as parents, we love our children and we want them to grow up and to prosper and to enjoy the most that life has to offer. And as God's people, we want them more than anything else to have a relationship with God as we do. Let's look at Psalm 127, verse 3. It says, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord." Children are a heritage from the Lord. There's something that are God's heritage that he gives to all of us. And so to have children is a most precious thing. It is a heritage that God gives to all of us. The fruit of the womb is a reward. A reward. You know, and we all are aware of what a reward is. It's something special. It's something that is given to us, and we're all thankful for the rewards that we receive. He says here, like arrows in the hand of a warrior. You know, if you're a warrior, and especially a bowman, you do want arrows in your hand to be effective. And your children are something that are precious and something that are very important to your life. And you know, we as parents, we love our children and we have many wonderful memories of them. You could see them up on the screen here today, and combined with music, and you see the kids grow up and they're getting taller and different birthdays and all of those kinds of things as they're coming along. And we all have those memories of our own children. They are a heritage from the Lord, and they are something that is very special. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. Some of us had smaller quivers. Some of us have larger. We felt our quiver was full at two, maybe three, but we had two. We're thankful for that. It says, happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate. You know, as we raise them and they grow to maturity, then they're going to be able to be in the gate where decisions are made and be able to help other people and help to make decisions and have wisdom that they can apply in that particular situation. So our children are a heritage that God has given to us, a reward that we can all be thankful for. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4. So God is working with the people of Israel and giving them instruction and thereby giving us instruction as well. And he says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord, our God, the Lord is one. There is no other God besides the God of Israel, our God. There is no other God besides the God that we know from the Bible." He says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." That's what we are to do with as parents. We are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, and with all our strength, with our entire being. And if we have that kind of love for God, it's going to reflect in the way that we deal with our children. It's going to reflect in the way that we teach them, and the way that we nurture them, and the way that we watch out for them and provide for them. It says in verse 6, "And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart." So God's word, God's instructions are to be a part of us, written on our hearts. And as they are written on our hearts, what they do is they are reflected in our words. They are reflected in how we act and in every facet of our lives. And as a result of loving the Lord our God with all of our hearts and all of our being, and these things being written in our heart, he tells us in verse 7, "You shall teach them diligently to your children." We're to take the truths of God and we are to teach them to our children, to pass along the heritage that we have received from God, to teach our children these things so that they can understand them and they begin to make sense to them. And it's a project. I know this morning, my wife was talking to my grandson about David. He wanted to hear a story. So she was telling him about David, and he told her, "I don't want to hear the story about David. I want to hear about the three pigs, the three little pigs." So I'm telling you, it's a project. They'd rather hear about the three little pigs and the huffing and puffing and all of that kind of things than about David sometimes. But we have to be persistent and continue to try to teach them the truths of the Bible, to share those truths with them, and to try to find a way to reach them with those truths that have become important to us. "You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house." So it's something that you talk about and focus upon as you're going about your day. When you're sitting around and there comes up an opportunity, a teaching moment, you take advantage of it. When you walk by the way, when you lie down and when you rise up. So basically God is telling us that we need to pass these things along to our children throughout the day. And unfortunately, you know, we aren't with them from the beginning of the day to the end as they were back in ancient Israel. But the time that we do have with them, we need to use it to pass along the positive things that we've learned. They need to see us pray. They need to see us discussing God's Word. They need to see us applying God's principles. And as they see us doing that, then it sets the helps to show them the path that they need to go down. He says, "You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes." They're to be something that is just a part of your life. Not just in a physical sense as it was here, but in a spiritual sense. "You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates." Your whole world is to be filled with this, and your children should know that. As you go on to the, let's go to Ephesians, where Paul emphasizes the importance of children and dealing with them. Ephesians chapter 6. And we see the instructions that are given in the Bible here about children and how important they are and what an important role that we play in their lives as their parents. And unfortunately, we see in the world so many kids that their parents don't attend to them. They don't put the time in with them. They don't teach them. The parents are unaware of the truths of the Bible and how essential they are, and they don't even know to pass these things along to their children. We know, and we have a wonderful opportunity to pass along the things to our kids. And, you know, we all try to do the best we can. And unfortunately, even though we do the best we can, our children are free moral agents, and we all hope that they will choose to follow the path that leads to God and eternal life, but they may not always choose to do that. But we still love them, and we still realize that they're important to God and they're important to us, and we love them whether they continue to follow the path or not. We all hope that they will. Ephesians chapter 6. It speaks here to children in verse 1. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." Now, if your parents are in the church and they're trying to teach you, it's basically telling you it would be wise to obey your parents, to listen to them and obey them, because they're trying to point you in the right direction. Like most of us, you're probably trying to point them, "Don't go there. I've been there. I've visited that. And it didn't work out well. Don't go there. There's a better way." And God spells out for you the better way. We all have done that with our children, trying to point them in the way that is right. It says, "Honor your father and mother," which is the first commandment with promise. And like, how do we best honor God? You know, he tells us, "If you love me, keep my commandments." That's how we best honor God. And the same thing is true with our, you know, as a child, the way you honor your parents is to obey them and do what they ask you to do. And, you know, as they point you in the right way, and they don't, usually they're not asking you to do anything that is going to be hurtful or destructive. If they do that, then you have to say, "I can't do that." But most parents aren't going to do that. They may ask you to mow the lawn, and that may seem out of line, but that's probably in your best interest to learn to do a little of that. And it's a good thing that you learn to do it. I know, but your parents are trying to help you to learn the right way, and by learning to obey them, it really helps you. It's a commandment with promise, it says, that it may be well with you and you may live long in the earth. As you learn to respond to your parents and respect them and to honor them by obeying them, it paves the way for you to be a good citizen. It paves the way for you to be a good employee. It paves the way for you to live long in the earth. You know, because that those individuals who are defiant tend to suffer greatly as they go through life. Well, nobody's going to tell me what to do. You know, I've heard a number of people say that over the years. and I know one man, the minister that I worked with in St. Louis, his parents were telling him what to do, and he finally said, "I'm out of here. Nobody's going to tell me what to do." So he went out and joined the Marines. and this was, I think, right around the time of World War II. And so he went out and joined the Marines, and next thing he knew, he was in the Marines and in China, which was an interesting tour of duty. So anyway, I thought, why did you choose the Marines if you didn't want anybody to tell you what to do? So anyway, he had a lot of that, people telling him what to do for a few years there in the service. But none of us, and so he battled that, and eventually he got through it. And all of us need to learn to, there are people going to tell us what to do, and by learning to obey your parents, it helps you with that facet of life. And then it goes on to say in verse 4, "And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath." There are things that we can do as parents that do provoke our children. Sometimes, you know, we get frustrated with them because they're not as cooperative as we'd like them to be. It's headbutting time most of the time, and it's hard to go through that. But you know what? As parents are to be mature and not to provoke them to wrath, which we can do. So this is instruction for parents as well, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. To rightly try to, instead of butting heads with them, to try to find a way to work with them. Find another avenue that we can go where we're not butting heads. And it's easy to butt heads. And, I've been a great head butter over the years. I'm willing to go and I'm not going to give in. I'm not going to compromise. But, you know, there comes a point where you learn it's not worth it. You know, it's like all of you, I can say you're going to do this or else, but that's not going to work. That's not really what leadership is all about. It's not that for a pastor or a father or a mother. You find a way to work with them where you can reach them. You know, God is extremely patient with all of us in the sense that He looks at us and He takes us and carefully works with us and He says, you know what, we need to go a different way with this person to reach them. And that's the way we have to learn to be. And that's part of our learning to be ready for God's kingdom. Because trust me, not everybody in the kingdom of God is going to be cooperative. They're not going to be. And if we're always butting heads with people, it makes it difficult to make any progress. It also tells us in Colossians chapter 3, verse 21, don't provoke your children because it can cause them to become discouraged. You know, as we're provoking them and butting heads with them, it can cause them to become discouraged. And we don't want to do that. So God says, look, ask for my wisdom and ask for my help in dealing with them in order that you won't provoke them, but you will help them to grow up in the training and admonition of the Lord. Let's go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 11. And here the writer of Ecclesiastes is talking to young people. He's a king with fabulous wealth, and he's had many different experiences. And he's learned various lessons along the way. And probably when he's writing the book of Ecclesiastes, he's an old man with a lot of experiences in his life. And unfortunately, in his particular case, if it is Solomon, It's very likely that he made some terrible decisions along the way and suffered the consequences, and the hope that is that the book of Ecclesiastes is him getting his act together at the end of his life. And so he tells us certain things that he's learned here about life and the various things that are available out there and what is essential. So he tells us some important things here in three verses in Ecclesiastes 11, beginning in verse 9 and going on to chapter 12, verse 1. He says, "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth." Not just young men, but young women. Rejoice in being young. You're young and you don't have all the aches and the pains. You have all the energy. You have lots of energy. And you know, when you go to sleep, you wake up and you're ready to have another big day and you're excited about it. And when you get up, usually you're not ache, you know, you don't have all those aches and pains. And oh, it's just tough to roll over and put my feet on the floor. You don't have that. You recuperate fast. I mean, you know, some kids say, "Well, we'd like to have 2 or 3 weeks of camp." I don't think I could take it. I mean, by the end of a week, I'm shot. And they're still ready to go, but that's because they're young. And I'm older, and I've got to get through this, and so I've got to keep pushing, you know, to get through it. And if it was 3 weeks, I'd find some way to do it, push on through. But I would be, boy, I'm not sure I would survive. But you're young and you have lots of energy and enthusiasm, and that's a wonderful thing. So rejoice in being young. And let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Yes, let your heart cheer you. And he says, walk in the ways of your heart. So, you know, you'll want to do this. You know, I'd love to do the zip line. I'd love to go whitewater rafting. I'd love to go bungee jumping. I'd love to drive my car 150 miles an hour down the freeway. All these kinds of things are going on in your heads and things you want to do. And yes, he says, walk in the ways of your heart. So follow some of those things that your heart wants to do, and in the sight of your eyes, those things you see and you'd like to try. He says, but know that for all these God will bring you into judgment. Yes, there are going to be all sorts of ideas that run through your head. All sorts of ideas. Some good and some not. And like he says, God will bring you into judgment. You'll be judged for what you do or what you don't do. All of us are. But sometimes as young people, we're filled with enthusiasm and drive and excitement, and we don't stop and think about God will judge us. Trust me, some of the things that you do as a young person, and you can jump and do all of the things that young people do, there comes a time when you'll feel all these aches and pains, some of them rather intensely, and you'll think back, yeah, I remember when I hurt my knee, or I hurt my back, and you'll remember it. You were young, you could take it. But when you get older, sometimes those aches and pains come back to haunt you. But it's not just your aches and pains physically, but spiritually as well. We can do things that damage us, and we're going to be judged for it, and we can suffer the consequences for it as well. God will bring you into judgment, and so he gives them this advice. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart. As you are excited about living, yes, be excited. Pursue the things of your heart, but choose wisely so that you will not sorrow, so that you prevent the sorrow being a part of your life. Now, there is some sorrow that's going to come your way no matter what you do. It's just the way life is. But there's sorrow that we can bring into our lives that we can avoid by our choices. Have fun, have a good time, but don't do things that bring sorrow unnecessarily into our lives. And put away evil from your flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity. You know, something that's fleeting, something that's not going to last. And you're going to have a different perspective as you get older. Things that are important to you now won't be important to you when you're 50 or 60. You just won't have the same perspective. It tells us, he goes on with advice in chapter 12, verse 1. Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth. You can have a relationship with God now. You don't have to wait. You can have a relationship with God right now. And he says, his advice is, do this before the difficult days come and the years draw near when you say, I have no pleasure in them. Talk to anybody that's got a few years on them and each day is more of a struggle because of the physical challenges they face. They'll tell you, yeah, it is a good idea to wise up before you're my age. You know, we'd all like to be young and have the wisdom that we have as we're older. I'd love to be 20 and have wisdom. We all would. But that's not going to happen. We have wisdom. We gained it over a lifetime of experience. But what the writer here is telling you is to remember the Creator, now your Creator, in the days of your youth before the difficult times come. Remember God. And remember that God is very interested in you. So just because you're a teenager doesn't mean that you can't know God and enter into a relationship with Him. You're never too young to enter into that relationship, to begin to consider it and think about it and allow it to motivate what you do and what you say and how you deal with your friends and your parents and everybody that you come into contact with. You know, we had last week, my wife and I were visiting, and so we didn't have the opportunity to go home and go to the pool. So my grandson, he's Mr. Rambunctious after church, and so Pete and Aaron were going to take Nolan down to the pool, and they got down there, and the pool was closed. They said the pool was closed because there was lightning. So anyway, another fellow there was not happy with it closing, and so they got into kind of a verbal sparring match there, and the one young man just lost control of himself. Lost control of himself and used foul language and threw chairs into the pool and all of this kind of thing. You know, that's where, as a young person, you can learn to deal with those kind of situations, which you will face in an appropriate way. People may be difficult. People may be challenging you, but you can learn to deal with it as you should. Let's look at a couple of examples here, three examples. Let's go to Genesis chapter 39. What do young people face and how did they deal with it? Genesis chapter 39, verse 7. Now, this particular story involves a young man who was sold out by his brothers. You know, there could be no greater betrayal than your own brothers selling you out. Imagine that. You know, it's bad enough when you leave home that your brother or sister says, I've got dibs on your room now, and they're glad to see you go because then they have their own room. That's pretty mild. But these guys said, we're going to get rid of this guy. And they did. They sold him into slavery. He ended up going to Egypt and ended up being bought as a slave by a man named Potiphar. And because of the training that he had had in his life, he became this man watched him and he said, this person is really a diligent person, somebody that I can count on. He saw the character that this young man had and he put him over his household. So let's pick up the story in verse 7. And it says that Joseph was a good-looking guy. It said that he was had a very positive appearance, and so this guy and he was a very successful individual. It says, now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Verse 7, and it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. So here he is, having been put in charge of this man's household, and the man's wife so tries to seduce him. So what does he do? In verse 8, but he refused. He refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. How can I betray this person's trust? How can I betray this person's trust? I may be able to get away with this, but I betrayed his trust. You see the character that Joseph displayed here. He says, he goes on to here in verse 9, "There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" So he knew what he was doing was wicked, and he knew it would be a sin against God. How could he do this? So it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day. So she didn't let up. She continued to try to entice him, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. So he refused to give in. "I'm committed to doing the right thing by God and by my master. I'm going to hold fast to that." But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. He was following an admonition that you find in the New Testament, which says, "Flee sexual immorality." He was doing just that. He's practicing it way in the ancient times. He knew what was right, and he was committed to doing it, and he would not give in to someone who sought to seduce him. It was a temptation. It was a temptation that for a young man is hard to do. But he said, "I will not give in to this. I'm committed to God, and I'm committed to doing the right thing." And he sets an example for all of us as Christians, and it tells us that as a young person, you can do the same. You can do the same. And you look at the outcome of Joseph's life and how God used him. And God can use you in the same way as you display that level of character. Let's look at a man by the name of Daniel. Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1. Daniel was living in adverse conditions. He was had been taken captive by the Babylonians and taken from his home and moved to the area of Babylon. And he had been chosen, along with some of his friends, to go into a training program in order to take on duties and responsibilities in the nation of Babylon. And Daniel was challenged. Daniel was challenged too, he and his friends. Daniel chapter 1, let's begin in verse 3. "Then the king," and the king was a man by the name of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a tyrant. He was intolerant of people making mistakes. And if people didn't do what he wanted them to do, he was very quick to eliminate them from the land of the living. He was brutal. He was harsh. He was a person who was very high on himself. And anybody who defied him sent him into a rage. So this is the king that they had to deal with. This is the king who had taken the city of Jerusalem and conquered the city, destroyed the temple, and he was a very, very ruthless individual at this point in his life. "Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans." So this was a special program to develop leaders that were going to be used in the Chaldean kingdom and as part of the palace. So he says, "And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies." So the king set aside certain things that were culinary delights from a Babylonian's point of view. And these would be made available to these people that were chosen to enter this program, these delicacies. "And the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now, from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They were chosen. They were given Babylonian names. And they were also made aware of what was going to be made available to them to eat. All these delicacies from the king and the wine that would be provided for the king. And Daniel saw what was offered. In verse 8, it says, "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank." So there was something wrong here, that if he partook of these things, it was going to cause his defilement. In all probability, what he was being faced with was that which was unclean. And he was not going to compromise with what he knew to be right. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. So he's having to make a stand. He could have kept his mouth shut and just gone ahead and done what was asked. But he said, "I can't do that because I'll know that I've compromised, and God will know that I've compromised, and I cannot do that." Now, God had brought Daniel into favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. So he was a person who developed a good relationship with this man who was in charge of the program. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king who has appointed you food and drink." So he knew what the king was like. And if I don't feed you, he's going to be pretty angry. And that's not going to go well for me. And he's going to be angry with you too. So he said, "For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king." So Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over all of the program and these Jewish young men, he says in verse 12, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Let me eat those things that would be pleasing to God for 10 days, and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you, and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies, as you see fit, so deal with your servants." So this man agreed, "Okay, we'll do that for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. They did what God told them to do, and they looked better than the rest of the people in the program. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables." So the eunuch said, "Hey, this actually works. We'll give him these things." But you see, they're having to, in essence, defy this great and powerful king who has real anger management problems. A king who would lop their heads off in a second. Just go on and continue reading in the book of Daniel and see what happened to his three friends as they're thrown into the fiery furnace. So you see here, here's a man, Daniel, and his three friends, they're standing up for what's right. They knew what was right, and they said, we're going to do it. Let's look at one final example in 2 Timothy chapter 3. A young man that the Apostle Paul became acquainted with as he began his missionary journeys in the land of, in the center of what's modern-day Turkey. He became acquainted with this young man and his family as he made those journeys and preaching the gospel with Barnabas on the first tour, and then they came back with a second tour. He and Silas came into these cities to encourage the people. And he developed a special relationship with this young man whose name was Timothy. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 10. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 10. So we have here, verse 10, it says, "But you have carefully followed my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, love, perseverance, persecutions, afflictions, which happened to me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra. What persecutions I endured, and out of them all the Lord delivered me. You've been acquainted with me through all of those trials and difficulties. You've looked at the way that I have lived. And I've tried to live as a Christian, tried to set a good example for you." He says here, "Yes, and all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution." That's what comes with living a godly life, it seems at times. But evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. This is what you're going to have to face, Daniel, or Timothy. You're going to have to face persecution at times. And you're going to be living in a world where there are evil men. Evil men and imposters. And there are going to be more of them, and they're going to have more of an influence, and you're going to have to deal with that. So what does he tell him to do in verse 14? But you must continue in the things which you have learned. You've been taught certain things. Continue in them. Continue in the things which you have learned and been assured of, knowing from whom you learned them. Continue to follow this path of teaching, an example that you've had. And remember where it all came from. He says, and that from childhood you have known the Holy Scriptures. How did he come to know the Scriptures from childhood? He came to know the Scriptures as a child from his mother and his grandmother. His mother and grandmother played a vital part in his life to help him to learn God's way of life, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. Those teachings that you have received from a child are able to make you wise for salvation. And that's what you're being exposed to as a young person, as your parents are teaching you and pointing you in that direction. And it's difficult to listen to that because there are so many pulls in another direction. And let's think about a couple of things. As our world moves toward a conclusion, we're told some things about the direction that the world is going to go. This is mentioned in Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah chapter 5. We're seeing what the prophet speaks of here playing itself out in our day. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20. And this is a warning. It says, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. If you look at the world in which you live, you find this taking place. Our world sees this going on right here, right now. Who put darkness for light? Who put darkness for light and light for darkness? Who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter? What it's talking about is you have people that are pushing sin in various forms and calling it good. And he said, woe to those who do that, convincing people to accept sin. Goes on to say in verse 21, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes. Yes, I'm smarter than everybody else, and I can promote this. Yeah, you may be smart. You may be highly intelligent, but you're smart in your own eyes, and where does that lead? It doesn't lead to anything good. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. There are a lot of people that look at God as a tyrant. They look at the Bible as antiquated and has no meaning for people today. We all need to cast all of that out and begin a new Christianity. Somebody sent me a link to a video from a particular program that's popular today. And in the program, the person's talking about how he doesn't want to have sexual relations at this time. And the other kid, because he's a Christian. The other kid said, well, I want to be a new kind of Christian and to have sexual relations. Is that a new kind of Christian? You can call yourself a Christian, but that practice denies that you are. So we see this happening in our world today. Many different sins are being promoted on various fronts and through various media. And to help us better understand that trend, that's why I brought up the Office Depot back-to-school promotion. And what is being promoted through that program? It is the promotion of homosexuality. There was a day when this would not have been an issue at all. Wouldn't have been discussed. Nobody ever would have brought it up, in all likelihood. But we live in a different world. We live in a different world than that. And so, not that I'm trying to get into some sordid subject here, but it's something that is going on in our world, and it's going to be pushed at you. It's going to be pushed at all of us. We live in a time in which the president has endorsed same-sex marriage. And when the president endorses something, it tends to cause many people to say it's acceptable. Just go back and look at the kings of Judah and the kings of Israel who promoted evil. They promoted it as the leaders of the country, and the people adopted it. And that's a bad thing. You know, you have a ruler, a person who's president who can really positively impact people, and unfortunately, they don't know any better, and they promote things that maybe aren't the best for the people. And as we look at our world today, the homosexuality has become a civil rights issue. What they look at is they look back to the time of most of the history of the United States for people who are African American. They have been discriminated against. There's been a prejudice, and it's been difficult for them. I mean, in talking to Billy Purnell, you know, she said she left Houston and went to Berkeley because it wasn't as hard there. For her as a black young lady, getting a degree in sociology was going to be difficult in Houston. So going to Berkeley was easier. That's the reality of much of our history as a country. So in the 1950s and 60s, you had the civil rights movement, which sought to open the way for everybody to have freedom and to be treated fairly in our society. And that's not a bad thing. But what's happened is the people who are promoting homosexuality have looked at that template and seen that homosexuals are mistreated and they're discriminated against in our time. And so this has become a civil rights issue. And for you to be against it is just like the people that were not allowing African Americans to go to a particular college or to get on the bus or to eat in a certain part of the restaurant. It's seen as that kind of a thing. The goal, then, is to get people to stand up for the discriminated minority. And that's a show of bravery and courage, of kindness and acceptance, to get involved in order to change the world. On the surface, that all sounds good, but the Bible tells us something quite different about that issue. And the Bible's where you have to go to make your decision about how you handle things and what you're going to support or not. Let's just look at a couple of scriptures here. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13. And there are a number of scriptures we could look at, but this is what we want to cite here for time's sake. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13. And it's pretty emphatic. There's not much doubt about what it's saying. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13. If a man lies with a male as he lies with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. What's taking place here is an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. It is a sin. It is an abomination in God's sight. And God goes on to tell us in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 that if you practice this, you will not be in the kingdom of God. You won't be there. So it's something that God takes very seriously. This whole issue has come into the headlines recently. A man who is the head of a company called Chick-fil-A expressed his views on this subject and paid a price. Dan Cathy, chief operating officer of Chick-fil-A, supports the idea of traditional marriage. Where could you go wrong with that? A man and a woman and marriage. And is opposed to the politically correct push to endorse homosexual marriage. For daring to express his view, he has been labeled homophobic, bigoted, and a restaurant chain has been targeted by homosexual activists for a boycott. Well, and when he was asked about this, the man replied, "Well, guilty as charged," is how Kathy responded to a Baptist press when it was pointed out that some are critical of Chick-fil-A's support of traditional values. "We are very much supportive of the family, the biblical definition of the family unit," Kathy said. "We are a family-owned business, a family-led business, and we are married to our first wives. We give God thanks for that." The way Kathy and Chick-fil-A have been vilified by some homosexual activists and media reports, you would think that their view was marginal and out of step with mainstream America. So as a result of what the fellow who runs Chick-fil-A said, a boycott of the company was called for. The mayors of Chicago and Boston condemned Chick-fil-A, told them they could not expand their franchises in their cities, and they really didn't want them in their city. As the mayor of Chicago said, "Your values don't fit with Chicago values." In other words, the company was to be economically sanctioned. Boycott them. You can't expand your business. And they're being sanctioned for standing up for the Bible, or supporting something they know to be true, that marriage is between a man and a woman. And to deviate, to support that, is seen as hate speech, discrimination, seen as evil. So, was Isaiah correct that a society could come to that point where they begin to call evil good? It happened in his time, and it's happening in ours. And the saddest thing of all is that this cultural war, which this is a manifestation of, is not going to stop. It's going to continue. It'll be continue forward on this issue and other issues. Matthew chapter 5, verse 6 tells us that we are to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Hunger and thirst for righteousness. That's what we want, is to be righteous. We, as Christians, are to hunger and thirst for righteousness. We are to, as parents, are to teach our children what righteousness is. Help them to be able to discern between right and wrong, good and evil, holy and unholy, clean and unclean. But if you hunger and thirst for righteousness and practice righteousness, what may happen? What may happen? It tells you in Matthew chapter 5 that you may be persecuted. You may be persecuted because you're doing the right thing. Hard to believe that. But it can happen. And that's, you know, Chick-fil-A is going through the very thing. They don't agree with us religiously, but they are trying to uphold the values they understand from the Bible, which is what we're trying to do, and they're suffering for it, and you can as well. Consider the mark of the beast. As you go back to Revelation 13, it talks about there is a time coming when you won't be able to buy and sell. You will be economically sanctioned because of your belief. Because there's going to come a time in which pressure will be brought to bear upon you to accept the mark of the beast, which appears to be the keeping of Sunday. And if you don't keep that day, you will be sanctioned economically. You will not be able to buy or sell because you say, the day that I should keep is the seventh. And we'll be challenged on that. And the question is, will we stand up for it? Will we conform in order that we can carry on economically? What we can see from all this is that Satan is going to bring pressure upon people to conform to his way, to get them to cave. And pressure is especially going to be brought to bear on young people in the church, because you are the most vulnerable. You are the most vulnerable. And he's going to bring pressure upon you. So what must you do as a young person? How do you deal with this? First of all, we must learn what righteousness is and do it regardless of the consequences. We are on a regular basis challenged to choose between right and wrong. Every day we are, aren't we? You are. You, probably, if you've grown up in the church, you know what's right and wrong. And as you're confronted, you have to say, what am I going to do here? Should I do what's right or not? Sin in various forms is around us all the time, we have to realize. And homosexuality is just one example of those sins. It's here. I don't think it's going to go away. It's something we have to learn to maneuver through in the right way. We're not going to eradicate that sin or any sins in this time. That's for a different age than we live in. That's why we go to the feast, because there will be a better age when all of these things will be corrected. We can be tolerant in the old sense of what tolerance used to be. Tolerance used to be, I disagree with you. I don't accept what you're doing or promoting or what you believe, because I believe in the Bible and it doesn't fit with the Bible. But you know what? I'm not going to mistreat you. If you need a drink, I'll give you a drink. If you need a ride home, I'll give you a ride home. I'll do things to just our kindness on the part of another human being. But I disagree with you on this point. And we should, as you hear all of the things about homosexuality or whatever it is, the propaganda, the pressures, the temptations to accept or give in to what is wrong, don't do it. Don't give in. If you have a doubt about what you should do or you should not do, you might look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 21 and 22. There it says, test all things. So somebody tells you something, you need to test it. Is it biblical? Is it pleasing to God? Prove it. And then hold fast what is good. And he goes on to say in verse 22, abstain from every form of evil. Don't do it. Abstain from it. Stay away from it. And you know, you may be persecuted for righteousness' sake. Christ was. You may be as well. And you know, as you do, God is very pleased with you. And you know what? You're forming a wonderful legacy for the future. Look at what God did with Joseph. Look at what God did with Timothy and Daniel. You're just as important to God as those individuals were. You have the same potential that those individuals did. But God is looking for people, old and young, to stand up for what is right and to be willing to suffer, if necessary, for what is right. And it's hard. That's hard for you to do. That's hard for me to do. But He wants you to be brave. He wants you to be courageous in standing up for what God tells us is right. And if you will do that, the reward is great. So be brave and be courageous as you stand up for God.